Today's conversation touches on spiritual matters, so I'd like to take a moment to briefly set the stage. You're all probably familiar with the word mindfulness, and you may also know that millions of people across the globe today incorporate some form of mindfulness meditation into their daily lives. But what's even more amazing is, did you know that this movement traces its roots in large part to Burmese Buddhist traditions? From historical giants like Lady Sayadaw to more recent meditation masters like Mahasi Sayadaw and S.N. Goenka, to contemporary figures like Sayadaw Utejaniya and Paok Sayadaw, these teachers have played pivotal roles in evolving meditation practices into accessible tools for modern lay audiences. These powerful and effective teachings of liberation and spiritual transformation, once confined to secluded monasteries and only instructed to lifelong monastics across Burma, today, they span continents and they reach millions of people from all backgrounds and religions. So with that backdrop, let's listen to today's guest, shall we? For this episode of Inside Myanmar podcast, we're pleased to welcome back Daniel M. Stewart, and we are going to be talking about his essay titled Local Cure, Global Chant, Leon Edward Wright, and the Healing Power of Ubiquin's Dhamma. And we encourage listeners to check that essay out. The link will be in the show notes if you're interested. This is a remarkable piece that opens several worlds at once. Dan begins with Lady Sayadaw during a plague in colonial Burma, how he is using chants, protective suttas, and what he's referring to as ritual therapeutics to literally fight disease. And from there, it's traced how these same protective frameworks evolve through Ubiquin's teaching in Rangoon. This is where meditation is not only about insight, but also about the balancing and protection of energies, the removal of obstructive dhatus, which we'll get into, and even the calling in of unseen forces through the crown of the head. The essay then goes into how S.N. Goenka inherited that world, but also in some ways erased it, translating metaphysics into scientific rhetoric and packaging a cosmic mission into something of a rational, universal, and modern framework. Finally, through all of this is where we come to Leon Edward Wright. This is a Black Christian theologian who studied with Ubiquin in the 1950s, experienced visionary states of light and transformation, and then carried those teachings home to Howard University in DC, where he began teaching meditation under the name of Creative Silence. So your essay doesn't just rediscover this forgotten figure. It also reveals this entire dimension of Buddhist modernism that's been written out. We're talking about the magical, the embodied, the performative, the cross-racial. It also challenges the scholarly story that has long flattened these teachers into like a psychology of mindfulness, which ignores the wider cosmology that they lived in. And so what emerges as you read this essay is not just a lineage of practice, but a lineage of healing from Lady Sayadaw's plague rites to Ubiquin's meditative cures to Goenka's sanitized rhetoric to Wright's hybrid theology of liberation. There's so many areas where we can start with the opening question. I want to start it with Leon Wright. I welcome you, to comment on any of this general introduction as well to flesh that out. But to ask a specific question, when you wrote about Leon Wright, it felt like you were resurrecting someone who'd not just been overlooked, but also this word erased. And so what first drew you to this story?
What first drew me to this story? Actually, I think it was somewhere. I don't know if it was on your blog or your podcast. I haven't listened to too many of those podcasts, and this was a long time ago. But there was some mention, I think it was by you somewhere, of Leon Wright, who I had heard of before, but I hadn't really thought that much about historically in my study of S.N. Goenka. And at that point, I looked into him and I was like, wow, this is an amazing figure. Like, it's pretty remarkable that he's been written out. I found a bunch of his articles, some of his books. And I thought, wow, this is an important issue to explore, particularly because, like, at that point, I had started becoming attuned to sort of the issues of race within the Goenka tradition. And I think this was also sort of kicked off in some ways by some of the conversations you were having, for instance, with Jonathan Crowley in the Goenka tradition and stuff like that. And this is also sort of came more to light later in conversations you had with Aisha Shahida Simmons. And I think you did a podcast with her actually on this topic. So it's funny, actually, my interest in him was, I knew about him, and I, in fact, I think even written about him at some point, but I had started looking into him, I think it must have been 2017, 2018, kicked off by something I found through you, Joe, which is funny how these things work.
Yeah, and, you know, credit goes back to Gustav Hauptmann, because this is yet another incredible footnote that he has in his 1990 thesis, which set my mind on fire. You know, he tells this whole story of Ukole being inspired by Vipassana practice, despite pushing it away for much of his life, through hearing a Leon Wright lecture at the American Embassy, or at the Burmese Embassy in DC. And that little nugget of tidbit that Gustav Hauptmann found left me with so many questions. I kind of talked the ears off of everyone I met for a while, just, you know, mentioning the story and the implications of it, and then certainly wrote about it in blogs and other things. But, you know, you then, with a greater rigorous academic focus, you were then able to pick it up. And that's what we're talking about here. And you've written about erasure as something more than omission, also almost a kind of violence that's done to the past. And so in Wright's case, what do you think that erasure says about how Buddhist modernism and the mindfulness movement remember their own beginning, we can say?
Yes. Well, I mean, of course, one of the key issues, you know, I also picked up on was, you know, this idea, for instance, in anti-colonial thought, right, about solidarity across various communities and traditions, sort of, you know, we had a global Asian or sort of an Asian, pan-Asian thought system that, you know, during the colonial period, where people started coming together, like people who were like Indians and Burmese, right, who had once sort of considered themselves different, you know, coming together, or in India, Muslims and Hindus coming together sort of to push out the colonialists, etc. And this is an important point, right? When we think about people like Martin Luther King and other folks like him, who were inspired in the civil rights movement, for instance, by the anti-colonial and decolonial movements of earlier times. And so it was surprising to me that generally the sort of anti-colonial aspect of a lot of this stuff had been removed, right? It's really central to Uba Khin's thinking, for instance. And it became even more interesting to find a Black theologian sort of right there at the center of Uba Khin's early mission, right? Suddenly removed for all the same reasons. And more interestingly, Leon Wright particularly had written about those issues before he went to Burma and was doing that work when he came back from Burma in the Black community in DC. So it's just, it has all of these elements of, like, you know, this is so important. This is the central, actually political kind of impetus for a lot of what's going on. And it's actually clear why it gets erased. And that's sort of one of the points I'm making, is like, oh yeah, that story is uncomfortable for many people. You know, the fact that this thing, which later becomes this rationalized scientific universal thing, might have its roots in a much more grounded political, local, and even you know, possibly, you know, somewhat violent, you know, to use that word in quotes, in the sense that, you know, it, there was this kind of, you know, movement of like against, right, through in this process. And this is something that's interesting when we look at Leon Wright's earlier work, right, where he talks, for instance, about Islam. When, you know, he was, of course, a Christian theologian, mainly grounded in the Christian tradition, but he was writing early on about Islam as a possible political force, right, for the Black community, right? And this is, again, in a sort of anti-colonial context where he's saying, look, we need to find resources in our world that's gonna, that are going to bring solidarity, right, to communities that are oppressed. And as a scholar of religion, he's looking at certain traditions like Islam, which are, you know, become sort of early global traditions, right, with these missionary movements. This is something that similar happened in Asia, right, where, you know, people in India, people in Burma, people in Japan are talking to each other and saying, like, hey, there's something we have in common, despite our differences, right? Look at this historical moment we're in, right? World War II, off, you know, was certainly got people thinking a lot about this kind of stuff, but if it had been stewing much longer, right? And so some of these modes were, okay, we need to look to Asia as a kind of identity formation, but often it was religious formations that sort of became the identity modes. So Buddhism became a really important node for that, right? Like Islam, right? It started in one place, very local, and then it spread out early on in history and had a, you know, really powerful impact across Asian communities, Asian traditions. Similarly with Islam, right? It spread out over, you know, half of the world pretty fast early on. And we can also say the same for Christianity. But in the political moment that Wright is interested in, right, certain modes seem to be more relevant. And it was interesting that he ended up in Burma learning this meditation and found that this was one way for him to sort of do this kind of work.
So what I find interesting with this story and the other work that you've done, and this really also segues into the last podcast that we recorded, our second conversation, and that's this sense that you're curious and you're looking into where there are these gaps in the story that we tell ourselves about how this practice came to us and what was inconvenient to leave out. And Dr. Leon Wright is one of those aspects that in some ways became convenient to leave out. And so there's this story within both within American Buddhist and Dhamma and meditator communities, as well as in the scholarly field as well, that that is practicing this kind of erasure and telling this other kind of story. And so this study into Leon Wright is not just about one person being forgotten. It's about this entire strand of spiritual history that was just simply inconvenient for the story that's been chosen to be told. And so what does it mean to bring it back now? And in what ways do you think in those different communities that this could cause a further reflection or being able to make room for this or to understand the meaning? And to what degree do you think that the stories that are being told are simply going to be impervious to this? And they're just, they're just kind of a structure that people, even when, you know, and this is something that goes beyond this issue. There's been psychological studies that have shown that when a narrative gets formed, because this is a narrative, whatever kind of narrative it is, that's why politicians are always trying to control the narrative. When a narrative gets formed, facts are not as important as the compelling nature of that narrative itself. You can create a new narrative, but it's extremely difficult, and studies have shown this, to be able to, even with facts, to be able to correct those existing narratives that have existed.
Yeah. So again, the real issue here is there are a lot of different kinds of conveniences and inconveniences. And this gets complicated very quickly when we actually look at Wright himself and his modalities, right? Like there doesn't seem to be any evidence, for instance, that he himself was that interested in reaching out to the other folks under Ubiquin, right? He had his own stuff that he was doing in the US, in his particular community. He was particularly focused on the Black community, and he was teaching in a theological institution that was also really for Black folks, right? So that's one key question, right, is like, you know, maybe he himself also had his own needs. What's also interesting is when we look at his own writings, particularly this really important book he wrote, From Cult to Cosmos, Can Jesus Be Saved?, which is sort of like a book he wrote later in his life, and I'd say it's sort of one of his more important pieces, also influenced clearly by the practices he had done with Ubekin, but not in any obvious way. It actually sort of mirrors in some ways what Goenka did, just in a different context. He's talking about psychology. Of course, he's much more interested in and sort of open about kind of paranormal things and stuff like that, but he's incorporating it into a similar kind of narrative that Goenka had about rationalism, psychology, and things like that. So again, it's funny how, like, as you put it, like, there's a common narrative because everyone is participating in a certain set of basic kind of movements, right? And this is why it's so important to talk, I think, about the anti-colonial piece, because that is in fact a narrative that I think almost everyone can participate in and understand, because it's so powerful in the history, for instance, of independence in India, right? Independence in Burma. And that's a pretty hardwired narrative, in fact. So it's actually not that hard if we can take this stuff seriously and this new information that we do have and sort of fit it into that bigger narrative. It starts becoming more clear that it fits. On the other hand, we have this later narrative about mindfulness, which also has its own life and is sort of hardwired in another way. And so it's the question of, like, can those two narratives actually come back together like they were, for instance, at least according to my research, in the earlier part of the 20th century? And that's a big question, whether it actually over time, you know, is possible. Again, people like Leon Wright are erased for a lot of reasons, but it's hard in that context, you know, to recover a story like that, precisely because he ended up being just marginalized at every level, right? Similarly with Ubekin, right? He ended up being marginalized precisely because of the inconveniences. But again, I think more and more the people who are interested in this, who participate in it and bring it into their own narratives, there's a real possibility, at least, that here and there these things filter out. But this is in many ways one of the sort of things I do at the beginning of my book, Insight in Perspective, which we talked about on the last podcast. I sort of say, hey, it's pretty amazing why some of this really important scholarship, for instance, the work of Gustav Hauptmann, has not really been followed up on or has not had the kind of staying power. And it's precisely this reason, I would suggest, that you're bringing up. It's that his very nuanced and idiosyncratic work, right, is hard to kind of put into these much more sort of the ruts of these other narratives. But I do think there is some work there that has been done, and there is a shift in a lot of ways for various reasons. And I do think particularly he, in his work, never really took the stuff in Burma, like the really close reading of Burmese cultural contexts, right, and sort of brought it out into the broader, Asian context, right, because he's an anthropologist, right? So there is, for sure, that first step is much easier to take, right, to tie these things into broader anti-colonial ideas that were going on in Asia. And then if what's so great about someone like Wright is, like, you can bring that from America and fit that into the same kind of issue, because the Black folks were thinking about the same issues, being in basically the same kind of problematic situation in the United States, right? Then there is more of a chance that these ideas, these people, these particular figures who have been erased can come back and be revived and fit into a narrative that's familiar to us. Gandhi's the great example, and you tie Gandhi to Professor King. You look at Leon Wright as really a forerunner of Dr. King. He was a little, before him and was sort of speaking in that context to a lot of the same ideas that became central in the later civil rights movement. So again, if those narratives are there to be tied into and we have to do that work, and then I think it's possible.
Yeah, right. And that's, you know, going into Hauptmann's work, it amazed me as I started to come across his books and his writings, how this was so off the map. I mean, this stuff has been around since, you know, 1990 was a thesis. I think 99 was the book. And his writings and views were for anyone interested in this stuff, they're so shocking and impactful and amazing. And how seldom, I mean, I think if ever I have ever met any practitioner really anywhere who has any understanding of him, which is why I've wanted to try to bring his voice and your voice and others on this podcast as kind of a medium or a middle ground of a way to make sure that some of these voices and perspectives and the work gets in. It's so important. Going back to Leon Wright, it's really interesting how you paint him as a, connected to some of these great figures and as a forerunner, and as Aisha reminded us on our podcast with her, you know, how amazing it truly was that in the pre-civil rights era, we're talking about the 1950s, that there was an African-American diplomat in Burma. And Burma was not the kind of backwater it is now. It was a really happening place. It was, to set the context, in the 1950s, you know, it was, this is when the Cold War was really taking off and most countries were aligned in Soviet or American camps. And there were very few that were trying to get out of this binary and that were in a non-aligned movement. As I often say, Burma was so non-aligned at that time that it kicked itself out of the non-aligned movement. It was too non-aligned for the non-aligned countries in PACT. And so because of that, the 1950s in Burma and Rangoon especially were this amazing soft power kind of a battle going on between, you know, the Soviets and the Chinese and the British and the Americans and everyone else. And so, you know, this was a very important posting, and it was a posting again by an African-American diplomat in the pre-civil rights era, which is really just stunning. And so as we start to get into Wright's story, and this story will tap us into Uba Khin, which will tap us into the lineage, which will tap us into strands of Burmese Buddhism, as well as outliers of Burmese Buddhism. But getting to Wright himself, in the essay, you describe how his visions, the light, the fire, hand offering a yellow rose, and how he saw these through the lens of Christ. And so how do you understand that moment, both as a scholar and someone steeped in Buddhist practice, this Christian, this very devout Christian that is not just undertaking a course of Buddhist practice, which, you know, that can still happen today, but as he's having this course in Buddhist practice and he's having these visions, he's also kind of interpreting and understanding his Buddhist practice through his Christian beliefs.
Right. So again, unfortunately, we don't have a huge amount of evidence on those visions. I mean, that is actually secondary evidence we have through one of his students, this guy who taught his teachings later. But it is, you know, it is amazing, those accounts. It's not surprising at all that he would have been interpreting things this way. I think I note in the article that he'd been very much interested in his own research on evidence of miracles and healing in the New Testament. And he received a Guggenheim Fellowship to do a project on that. I actually never saw the outcome of that research. But he was very much interested in the, you know, this material in the New Testament. So he was already attuned, I think, to this way of thinking about religious experience. So if he did encounter these powerful signs that are actually quite common, there are a lot of accounts of these in the early Buddhist context and later Buddhist contexts. And in fact, there's a whole repertoire, particularly in Chinese Buddhism, of sort of explaining the different signs and what they mean karmically, etc. I mean, it's not at all surprising if he had some of those experiences that he would interpret them through the lens of his own tradition or have some sense that there's a relationship. And of course, you know, there's there's plenty of evidence in the New Testament, though it's a very small book, of, you know, that Jesus as a figure was living in a visionary world to some extent, a world filled with the possibility of miracles, etc. So again, depending on one's position as a historian or a literary person, we can all read the Bible in a lot of different ways. But there's really no question, right, that theologically, if we go and take seriously the stories and the ideas in the Bible, that there's a lot there that could be drawn on if one were to have experiences of this sort. So yeah, I don't find that all that surprising at all. I do think there is a, you know, something that Uba Kin was also trying to do, and we see this a lot in other traditions too. I don't know if, you know, you've read, for instance, the classic book by Paramahansa Yogananda, Autobiography of a Yogi, but that's sure. A wonderful example, you know, I think it's even earlier, right, of the very same kind of, you know, comparative work that gets done, right? Someone who's had a lot of visionary experiences on the ground in their own tradition, and then they start reading the Bible, and they're like, oh, like, right, we can find a lot of these experiences I've had, like, you know, somehow relatable in these terms in this book. So this is very common in, like, traditional comparative theology, but also within the frame of sort of modern mysticism, which has looked for some universal set of experiences that could be, you know, there some parts of it are culturally constructed and other parts have some universal aspect that we can all tie into and might, you know, be able to talk about. And that's the kind of stuff that Leon Wright ends up getting into later on when he talks about, when he takes the practices and makes, like, the Christian tradition more psychologically explainable. And this is where it's worth looking at his book, From Cult to Cosmos, because, you know, the subtitle there is Can Jesus Be Saved? And it's precisely this idea of, can we take these earlier, like, you know, very grounded, particular traditions of the Christian, the early Christian Bible, and map them to a more modern psychological idea. And he uses precisely the meditation that he developed from Uba Kin, right, as a bridge to do that, which is, of course, interesting. And so then this is also something I would say that's similar to the kind of stuff Goenka did later on in his missionary work, particularly in India, when he was meeting people from all walks of life and trying to get them to see the common threads in these traditions.
Right. That's very true. Looking at this thread in this case, or you know, there's several threads in here that we can say that Wright is pulling on from both from his tradition as well as what he's tapping into Burma. One of these threads would be healing, and that's something that you go into with this essay, and you show how Leidy's model of healing, this idea that disease could be supernormal, that demons resist removal. It, as I understand it, it becomes part of the cosmological scaffolding that later shapes Uba Kin's teaching. That last line, I would pause just for a moment saying, would be very controversial and would have, you know, quite a bit of pushback from dedicated Goenka meditators, which I want to get into, just, you know, how the ways in which healing, you found healing taking shape in among those lineage figures, and where the discomfort comes in the way that that it's that again, we could say this narrative, this constructed, fabricated narrative that exists today, that in some way is impervious and pushes back against some of these facts and details. You know, why this kind of research and these kinds of stories, why they pose a threat or discomfort, and when we're looking at Uba Kin's work through that lens, does that in any way change your understanding of what Vipassana was meant to do? Because this is really getting at the core of the issue, or how, and then moving on to how it's then formulated in practice today.
Yeah, this is a big question. And it is complicated because, of course, like, Uba Kin was living across traditions, right? And, you know, as was the Ledi Sayadaw. And that's why I look at those moments in the Ledi Sayadaw's manual, the Rogantara Dipani, right? The manual for warding off plague or pestilence. And in that Deepani, right, he's explicitly noting his own context and acknowledging that the power of modern medicine, right? And then alongside that also saying, but there's also the power of our traditional models. And they're different. At different times, they're going to be effective in different ways. The modern medicine is powerful. And this is an interesting thing because I think there's continuity in that sort of parallelism all through the tradition. And it's more like when and how are there these moments where, you know, one takes precedence over the other, right? And one is more powerful than the other. And the classic example is, of course, and I've talked about this and written about it in the biography I wrote of Goenka, right, is Goenka's own story, right, of how he got into meditation, right? And the classic point is, oh, there were these migraines, right? I was afflicted by migraines for years. I was taking modern medicine. It didn't work, right? It wasn't enough. It couldn't solve my problems. Then I went to Ubaken, and it solved that problem. And of course, we can now talk about this language of datu, right, or dat, because that's exactly how Ubaken diagnosed Goenka's problem at that time, right? He said, okay, this is a different kind of issue than like the standard painkillers and medicines will address. This is an issue of dat. You have this element within you that needs to be removed. And the meditation teacher is the one to do this. And so I, you know, that account is there. Ubaken actually tells that account in his own words in one of his Dharma talks, and that's in my book. And Goenka told that on every 10-day course that he ever taught, and it's in the recordings of how it happened. And they're told in different ways. And Goenka sort of, again, this is a case of, in many ways, of an erasure, in that, you know, Goenka explains the idea that his migraines went away through meditation, but of course, in Ubaken's account, the migraines went away the minute they met, and Goenka bowed down to him and sort of took him on as his teacher before ever doing a meditation course. So that's an interesting, you know, two interesting narratives that sort of give us a different picture on that relationship to healing, to medicine, etc. And then this is a dynamic that runs through the whole tradition because, you know, you have figures like Om Prakash, who is, you know, a close friend of Goenka, who's an Indian doctor in Rangoon, who went to Ubaken and did meditation. Apparently, he became a stream enterer on his first course, according to the stories of the tradition. You know, he was a doctor, and he kept doing medicine after, of course, becoming a student of Ubaken. But what we do have accounts of him saying is, oh, like, I used to be not as good a doctor before I did meditation with Ubaken. I gave the medicine and it worked. But once I started doing meditation, I gave the medicine and it worked better. that's one story that you'll find in one of the newsletters about Om Prakash. So that's a very good example of the way that within the tradition, there's this idea that in fact, there's this sort of, you know, medicine of course is powerful, but in fact, the relationship of medicine to like a certain kind of practice also like there's a kind of symbiosis that can be going on in those connections. And this of course fits very well with some of the more recent research on how medicine works more generally in the West, in that like actually it's not just about the medicine, it's actually about a relationship to the doctor, it's how we feel in the context of being doctored, et cetera, et cetera. And this is something that I talk about in the article about Leon Wright, is that the whole notion of going to a meditation teacher and having a relationship with them, often there's some devotional aspect, but often the teacher is also sort of bringing to the table the kind of thing a good doctor would bring to the table. That is just a good bedside manner that makes someone feel comfortable, held, and has this powerful psychological effect. So that's all along been in the tradition and been part of the tradition, but it's happening in various ways and it's very complicated. And this is why it's really different what the kind of teaching Ubakin did compared to Goenka, because Ubakin was working very closely with his individual students. He was tailoring the teachings to every student. He did have this kind of very clear bedside manner with every single one of his students. With Goenka, he had these large courses. He wasn't necessarily really giving that kind of attention to the individual students. Maybe early on he was, but later on it didn't happen. So that's how one of the reasons the tradition changed. Another story, which I think I actually mentioned at some point in the article, is this story of Goenka doing much more sort of healing modalities of teaching meditation early on in India, where they would, for instance, gather people around if there was someone sick in the community, and they would do like circles of metta practice. So they would sort of put someone in the middle of a circle, they would all gather around, and they would send metta to the person so that they would get better. So that was like an explicit practice of using the power of their meditative like community to bring health and well-being to an individual. That's a story, again, that was told to me by one of the people I talked to in India. And very early on, there was sort of an idea, well, we should maybe stop doing this because, you know, ultimately, this isn't what the meditation is really about. It's about liberation. It's not about this stuff. And if we do this kind of stuff publicly, people will start talking about this is what it's really about, et cetera, et cetera. And that's actually the kind of rhetoric we start seeing in most of Goenka's standard courses, which is like,
yes.
But this was a long process. And also at different times, at different places, there was a different emphasis depending on, you know, what was going on. So there's a lot there, like in a few of those anecdotes, it just shows that going from Lady Sayadaw all the way up through today, there actually has been this constant sort of back and forth between, you know, is mindfulness or is meditation for health and well-being? Is it for salvation, right? Can it be for both at the same time? What's the relationship to traditional, to Western medicine? What's the relationship to traditional healing and other kinds of medicine? So it remains a kind of gray area, I would say. But I think more and more you have, particularly in the Goenka tradition, this idea that it's really the healing stuff will happen as a byproduct, as a natural byproduct, but that shouldn't be the main focus of the practice.
Right. And as you paint this complicated and nuanced history, narratives have to be simple to take hold. We can't really hold in our minds the level of actual complexity that that we really find when we look into something. So we have to have these simplistic narratives that give us comfort. But then, you know, on the flip side, they give us discomfort when we have to get back into that nuance if we choose to, that then starts to break that narrative down that we all thought we knew so well. And that's where, you know, this aspect of healing comes in, because it's there is a very specific way that healing gets healing or byproducts of health or these other things get told in modern movements and in the Goenka organization. And so then which perhaps is something of an overcompensation or maybe just a sanitized version. But then when we go back and hear these things, we don't know where to put them. Because there's been this other narrative that's taken its place that we think we understand, and this starts to kind of poke holes in that. And you know, you even when you mention about the circle of metta, I mean, I'm reminded in my early days of Goenka meditation, when you were a server and the course finished, metta the process of metta was different, and Goenka changed it along the way after years and years of doing it in a certain way where the students would passively receive the metta from the teachers. He changed it to everyone, all of the servers actively giving metta to everyone else. And I don't know exactly the reasoning for that, but I know for me as a student, it was a pretty special experience as a server, and depending on the teacher and your own sensitivity, to be able to sit there and passively receive what you could really feel as these this kind of vibrational quality of in some ways that would restore and energize you in ways I'd never experienced. And that being taken away seemed a shift along the line, a subtle shift along the lines of what you were saying, that because there was something in that process that did feel, you know, in a very minor way, therapeutic.
I think I was around right when they made some of those changes. And it was, I think there were a few specific experiences, I think, that led up to that. And it, again, it had to do with people like wondering about this relationship of these things. And so, I mean, it's a little complicated. But I do think the general idea, the real issue that arose and why they shifted it, right, was that traditionally the idea, right, was that Ubakin would radiate his metta out to everyone, and anyone or like who was able to tune into it when he did that could receive the metta, right? And the way that Goenka set this up later on with his assistant teachers was that sort of the assistant teachers would become a sort of node for that, and then like the servers and students would sort of be able to tap into that when they sat with the teacher at the end of the day. At some point, there was an experience where an assistant teacher was there on the Dhamma seat. They were going to do this. Somehow he got agitated and like was unable to serve this function. And there was a discussion of this. And so I was on a course at, like right when they were adjudicating this, where the teacher said, okay, we're no longer going to do this anymore. Instead, the teacher's going to get down off of the Dhamma seat, sit with the servers in the same way, and all of us receive the metta, you know, kind of in a group, not through the like medium of the assistant teacher. And very quickly, when people started doing that, it was like, wait, this doesn't work the same way it used to. We need to go back to the model we had before. So they switched it back, but they did shift the language at a certain point to just not talk about the mechanism of how that works. And in particularly not focusing on this sort of relationship to the top of the head as a sort of what we might call in traditional Indian religions a chakra, right, which is a sort of energy center that's able to sort of tap into, you know, larger cosmic forces. So that language just got removed from the conversation, but I think almost all of the, at least all of the ATs in the community sort of still conceptualized it happening that way. And so this is like again a classic example where they remove certain ideas from the public rhetoric, but there's still a sense that it goes on this way anyway. And that's, again, everyone will experience those things differently. And I remember a friend of mine at some point saying, like, you know, they've taken away, they've sort of cut off this really important concept in our tradition. Like, why would they do that? You know, she was bummed out when they did that, because this it did kind of remove the, maybe for some people who have a more devotional sense of connecting to a higher force, mm-hmm. right? That was like, you know, kind of taking something away from certain people. In thinking about like the work I've done in this article on Leon Wright, it's really interesting because that stuff does go back to the Leti side, this notion of the fontanelle as this key energy center, that where one can access the blessings of the Buddha, etc. You know, and that there were these ritual practices that were already there very early on in Burma that like did that kind of thing with incantation. So that's an interesting historical precedent for that practice that many people might not be aware of.
All of this also reminds me where we then bring Friedgard in and some of her firsthand memories. Friedgard Lodermoser, the German woman that we've done a series of podcasts with, who passed away in 2024 and studied under Ubakin. And there's a line in there that I always remember when I think of this, that just blew me away when she said it. And to set this line up, the remarkable thing about Friedgard is how she takes you into a story. And she comes across as a very reliable narrator, partly because she frames herself as a young German transplant in Burma at that time, as someone who is well-intended and awkward and bumbling and naive and kind of getting in front of herself and having good intentions, but often those good intentions being, turning into rather embarrassing moments that she then has to recover from. And that, you know, becomes her journey and her learning of integrating into Burmese meditation and culture. And one of those incidences, and this is, I just laugh even before I say this, is she's talking, 17, 18 years old, talking to Ubakin. And Ubakin is referencing something about the planes of existence and the invisible beings and, being able to travel to different, to these different planes and past lives and kind of, hearkening back to some Buddhist descriptions of a kind of phantasmical, of the phantasmical cosmology and describing it. And he's just describing this and Friedgard responds something like, "Oh, that's really cute that you're describing all of this and that you have some belief, that these things might be real. Like that's, I like that." And, Ubakin just looks at her mouth agape the way she describes it and says, "These things are absolutely real. I've experienced all of them." I don't remember exactly how he puts it. And of course she's paraphrasing, but it's this incredible moment where Friedgard has a first awakening that these extraordinary things that Ubakin is describing are not part of a mythological, to him, they're not part of a mythological or religious or cultural landscape. They are as real as anything else. And then, later episodes, Friedgard goes on to describe structured meditation instructions that Ubakin delivers that are both and these, to be clear, these are not standard instructions that are given to every student on every course, but they were instructions that Friedgard was a fly in the wall and a witness to hearing these exact specific instructions in certain cases, where Ubakin described both the experience of recollecting past lives as well as the experience of traveling through planes through different planes, and that these were being delivered technically to various students at various points, and Friedgard heard this. And so this kind of reinforced, her, and I don't know to what degree Friedgard herself experienced this, but these incidences certainly reinforced her realization that this was not just kind of a cute thing to draw upon. And but this is like the early iteration of her experience with Ubakin, and she uses this to then show, how she grew and moved to understand it. You yourself write that Ubakin, quote, perform the Dhamma, that he, following what Friedgard said, invoking forces, drawing in beings, channeling energy through the top of the student's head. And to many modern ears, that can sound quite unbelievable. And so how can we, looking at some of Friedgard's observations and, as this critical Westerner trying to practice meditation and hearing these stories, as well as understanding the modern meditation movement, how can we understand that dimension of Ubakin's teaching and what it means in his own metaphysical logic?
For me, that's not a huge complication. I think this is why I wrote the book on Insight and Perspective, right? Because I think it's pretty clear that the Ledi Sayadaw, Sayataji, Ubakin, they were all in a world in which this stuff was real. They could access it in their own ways, right? And they communicated it in their own ways, but they were, kind of communicating a vision of Theravada cosmology that, fit with certain textual ideas, but also related to certain experiences. And I think this is why it's also really important to bring in Mother Sayama as Ubakin's co-teacher, because, it was pretty clear, and this is also something I got from Friedgard at a certain point, that, her way of seeing past lives and being able to also see the past lives of other folks, Ubakin's students, was important for the formation of that teaching model. This is something Friedgard also mentioned to me, that, for instance, Sayama could see people's mind stream when they were in these states of meditation, and then they could actually help to work on them and teach them in a certain way in these key moments in the model that they used to break the mind stream and push the student into nibbana. So that was a really key part of And it was, I think, a very concrete experiential thing for them. Now, again, depending on where one stands in how one has experienced the world, right, that may or may not be, you know, believable, accessible, amenable to one's conceptual world. But, you know, that's certainly the historical evidence we have that all of this was a big part of how the teaching went on and, you know, was really fundamental for the formation of the cult that surrounded Ubakin. And I think, you know, again, when we take those accounts, you know, very limited accounts we have of Leon Wright's experience, visionary experiences, that also fits in. But of course, he was putting on an interpretation from his own tradition.
Mm-hmm. And then as we look at this, at how this tradition started to spread and take on other aspects according to one's background or personality, I want to bring it back to Leon Wright, because you describe Leon Wright performing healings through touch and prayer where students felt energy move through them. He called it the overflow of the spirit. So how would you interpret that in light of this conversation we've been having with the modern meditation movement, the background of Burmese Buddhism and Ubakin's center particularly? Do you see this as a continuation of Ubakin's understanding of Dhamma power, we can say, or is this something distinct and new or integrated into Wright's own Christian identity?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. And it's, of course, a little bit difficult to know unless we would talk a bit more with Leon Wright about this. But because, again, that account comes from, you know, an article that was written by someone who interviewed him and something she saw at the church when she visited him. But I do think in many ways, if we're trying to find connections and between these experiences, this notion of an overflow of spirit could very easily be mapped to the notion of sort of our of dhat or dhatu as sort of fundamental parts of the individual within the Buddhist context that also interpenetrate with the whole universe, right? And so I think there's a way for there to be a kind of relationship there, but the language is different. The traditions are, you know, have different concepts. But I do think there's very much Leon Wright's experiences with Ubakin likely, you know, had some relationship to what he was doing later. And so I think it's very likely that there is a conceptual kind of spectrum here that would fit. But we don't have enough evidence, and maybe it'll be forthcoming because there are people in, you know, DC who are carrying on Leon Wright's practices. I'm not sure like how like steeped he was in the Burmese tradition and over the Burmese language to necessarily be able to even know for sure, like, precisely like those concepts. So he was just going on his experiences, and this is what happens. Experience is hard, you know, once we put it into words, once we put it into a certain frame, you know, and we start talking about it. But my sense is that probably at a baseline, you know, level, what was going on and the sort of ability to access the relationship between, you know, like a teacher and a disciple and sort of the way that energy gets exchanged between human beings in, like, whether it's a psychological context or a spiritual context, right? That interpersonal thing that's constantly going on between people and other beings, right? That there's a spectrum there that both would fit into and sort of be in conversation with. But it is an interesting case that Leon Wright spent not that much time with Ubakin, and then he went on and did his own thing in a very particular social context. So it's, you know, that's again part of this whole story. We'd love to have more information about Leon Wright, and this is something that, you know, I discussed with Aisha Shahida Simmons, who was really interested in Leon Wright as a figure, and we were thinking we should do a bigger project on him and really, like, really it's deserving of a book, like,
yes,
like his story and what he did. There's a lot more there. I'm hoping she's going to do that, but I'm not sure if that'll happen.
It's so true. And, you know, it's, As significant as Leon Wright's story is, I'm also juxtaposing that with like Ullo Cananta, the Italian monk who we've done two episodes on, or Damaloca, the Irish monk. This is at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, even before these other two, which we also did an episode on based on the book by Alicia Turner and Lawrence Cox, and how each of these characters, you know, each of these individuals that whatever little we're able to know and reconstruct of their lives, and all three of these people, we should say, the scholars associated with trying to understand their lives and their understanding their teachings, you know, a huge part of their stories is the difficulty of uncovering their stories. It's, you know, tremendously difficult work. I mean, we spend the first 20 minutes with Lawrence Cox on our episode about this book, The Irish Buddhist, talking about how extraordinarily difficult it was for three, you know, bona fide academics working in tandem together as a team to reconstruct anything of Damaloca's life, and how there is in fact more unknown and more questions than there is known. So this is really tantalizing. And I think the more that we talk about these things, the more that we at least for me, it starts to go from feeling like, well, we have a narrative that's formed, that's more or less what happened, to, oh, well, there's some holes in the narrative and there's these kind of things which pose us questions, to, oh, the narrative's it's a bit troubled. It's a bit, you know, it's not quite accurate, to like, what do we really know actually? You know, like, what do we, how did we come to know what we think we know? And there's, how much is really missing from the stories that we tell ourselves? And that's part and parcel of so much of the work that you do as well.
Yeah, well, it's a great point. But honestly, with Leon Wright, we have a much firmer ground than with those other two figures. By the way, if we're talking about putting, you know, narratives together, all three of those folks, the anti-colonial narrative, they fit into, right? Uh-huh. That's one thing that ties those folks together. You know, Lokanatta is this really interesting case of the tie to Ambedkar. That's a really interesting case. So the sort of, you know, connection to the either, you know, low caste communities, black folks, right? Again, the Irish, who were basically, you know, kind of underlings within this larger colonial system. That's one key piece that ties them all together. But yeah, I do think we would like more information. But in this case, there are people living today who have had connections to Leon Wright, and there's like information that we could get that's there. There's more of an archive that is to be accessed. I just haven't done that work, but the work could be done. And it's, I think the prospect of knowing a lot more about him is in fact there. And we should do that work. Whether I'll have time to do that, or I had actually proposed to Aisha that we would work on something like that together. You know, this is always hard to bring people together. We have busy lives.
we hope it happens, you know, for the sake of history. We hope it happens.
But yeah, I do think he's an important figure that deserves more attention. Absolutely.
And so then as we're telling this story, and this is a story we've told in different ways at different times on the podcast, but this is a particular way of coming at it. We come to Cuenca, and as you put it, he did an incredible job of effacing his ontological commitments through the language of science and secularism. When we look at Cuenca, to what degree was he consciously translating a cosmic vision into modern terms? And to what degree did he start to believe the new rational version? We have this, you know, overall, I'm setting up this dynamic of this juxtaposition between, which is at the heart of so much of what you do and so much of this mindfulness movement today, which is this kind of these messy things which have fallen in gaps of badly and unseen forces and the different planes of existence, and we can put past lives in there, so much of this greater cosmological battlefield, playing field, into the more sanitized version that it's described in modern times.
People can look at that in insight and perspective. It's sort of like kind of the part on the relationship between Cuenca and the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts, the founders of which were Joseph Goldstein, J. Jack Kornfield, and Sharon Salzberg. Kornfield's dissertation is actually pretty standard kind of science. It's like one of the earliest examples of the scientization of mindfulness. But what is interesting is it's actually very grounded in the experiences and much more sort of clear than, say, I would say, like the later stuff done by like Jon Kabat-Zinn, that this is grounded in a tradition, that in fact there are challenges, you know, there, it's not just a catch-all, like, gonna heal everyone, right? It's just what I think I take Kornfield's dissertation as actually one of the better examples of earlier scientific-like work. What I also suggest is that he was influenced by Robert Hover, who was, you know, one of Uba Kin's students, to do this kind of work, and that Robert Hover is someone who was erased historically for a variety of reasons. We can maybe talk about that later because it's complicated. What he did do was he got, you know, involved in the ethics of the tradition precisely because it was a pretty messy situation early on for those folks, and they ended up in a situation where they really needed to sort of ground themselves in the ethics of the early tradition with a more Western frame. So that's, again, a very similar process, but with a different set of emphases. I think that at every level here, there's a chance that one can construe what went on as dishonest because things got omitted, et cetera, et cetera. In the case of Kornfield, I think he's one of the more honest of folks, I have to say. I have a lot of critiques of some of what he did, but for other reasons, I think he was one of the more forthright kind of folks to engage these issues. He tried. But again, my critique of what he did do was he misread Uba Kin, and he scientized Uba Kin. And I think that, you know, I don't know if he did that on purpose or just didn't have enough knowledge, honestly, of what Uba Kin was really up to. But that's just, for me, like a critique of the information that ended up getting out there. In his book, Living Buddhist Masters, he didn't really account for Uba Kin, who Uba Kin really was. So that's my critique. But also, it's not particularly surprising that that would have happened. He did one course with Uba Kin, I think, and didn't spend a lot of time there. The case with Goenka, again, I think I said this last time, and maybe people don't want to hear it, but I think this is also my own experience, is that like these are just different frameworks for understanding reality. And as someone who, like myself, has experienced sort of both sides of this directly in meditation, there are definitely moments where one can say like, oh yes, this entirely fits a rationalized, secularized way of conceptualizing the universe through sort of certain scientific models. And then in another moment, it could easily be an experience that like, there's no way that our modern scientific models could explain this. Right. And as science gets more and more wild by the week in our lives, it's actually getting even more complicated to do that, right? To make those equations. But for sure, if we're talking about sort of some of the like cultural frameworks that were there in, you know, 19th century Burma that had remnants in some of Uba Kin's thought system, these are just different ways of thinking. And like, it could easily be that Goenka came to a point where he thought, you know, the people of today, like this isn't going to read to them. So yes, it's cultural translation. I also imagine a moment where Goenka himself experienced some things and with his limited understanding of science said like, oh, this does fit. Yeah. And again, I'm pretty sympathetic. I'm trying to be a sympathetic reader. I can't say for sure. I'm also quite certain there were strategic moments where Goenka said, we're not going to talk about this. It's complicated and it'll turn people off. Yeah. And where he came along with sort of social developments, you know, for instance, his position on homosexuality, you know, that's something, I don't know if you talked about that with Jonathan Crowley, but that's something that like they had to address within the tradition at a certain point. So these kinds of things, or like the role of women, like for a long time, they couldn't actually sit on the Dhamma seat, right? They had to sit, or rather they were sort of sitting below, and we see this with images of Ubakin and Mother Sayama early on. You know, there are these different things, or women couldn't sit on the Dharma seat when having their period, right? That was a rule for a long time for, you know, reasons that there is an idea about that cosmologically about those ideas. And that's, that idea continues in a lot of Southeast Asia, if you go now. So the gender stuff, the stuff about homosexuality, other kinds of things, social things, Goenka realized, well, it's not helpful to hold on to these things when I'm trying to teach everyone universally. It will turn people off, or in worst cases, they won't get access to the Dhamma, and everyone should have access to the Dhamma. So this is, actually doesn't serve the purpose. And so that's, things like that. So it's hard to come down hard on one way or another, but I guarantee that there are probably moments of, what we might conceptualize as dishonesty, like covering things up or changing how one talks about things for the purpose of spreading the Dhamma. And then also like genuine commitment to the different frameworks and the idea that actually one can talk about these things in different ways from different cultural perspectives. And there is some universal ground that like experientially we can all come to.
I appreciate that answer. And I think the most that we can do is to provide those listeners or readers in your case with that understanding of what came before and show then how it's portrayed today and the reasonings and the rationale, the distinctions, the connections between those two things. In some ways, we can leave that in the individual minds and agency of those individuals, and that could be a value judgment and an interpretation that one can make on oneself. It's just so important to make sure that these things do not get erased, which is what we're doing and what you're doing especially. I do want to prompt you on the one thread you put out there, because this aspect of how Goenka dealt with homosexuality. It's something that's come up in several podcasts before, but it's never been it's never been something that's been talked about head on, exactly what that issue was. Anecdotally, personally, I can share from my own experience as a student. I remember my very first course serving, there were two gay students who came, and I remember very clearly the assistant teacher on the course, as we were coming together, telling us as servers, might sound strange to say this, but saying it in a compassionate way, that that this was a defilement they needed to come out of, like everyone else needed to come out of. They'd come out of in their own time, and this practice would help them. I mean, words that would certainly be quite triggering, that kind of touch upon conversion therapy or something today. Contrast that with a conversation I had just 3 days ago, where I was speaking with a center teacher who told me with great pride in his voice that they had just hosted the first course for trans and non-binary people, despite some misgivings and pushback against other teachers, that this particular teacher and others with him had been able to accomplish that, and just how much pride and happiness he had in being able to figure out how to put something like that on. And so just a snapshot of two ends of my experience. Can you take it from there and talk about what you understand of where this issue came down?
Well, I mean, it's complicated. And honestly, I think people within who are more involved within the tradition should speak to it. So of course it's a traditional, Buddhist idea, right? That of course all sexuality is a defilement.
Yes.
That's just understood, right? But that in a sense, these particular modes of sexuality are, more problematic because they are not, they're not the design of the standard biology. That's classic. That's just classical early Buddhist idea. It's not actually very clearly laid out in the early canon. There's no clear position on it anywhere in the earliest texts. it's later in commentarial literature, and, you know, a lot of like kind of Shastric literature in the Sanskrit tradition has some stuff about this. So it's important to note that there's just no explicit clear position, but most Asian contexts, if you go there and look at what they're teaching about Buddhist, like classical Buddhist ideas, you will find something there that just notes that, hey, you know, this of course doesn't fit that well with some of the ideas in Southeast Asia, which are in fact often quite open to,
yes,
you know, gender, you know, fluidity, etc.
Right.
Including in Burma, where there's a, you know, there are whole, you know, it's interesting, particularly in context of mediumship, a lot of the mediums there are tend to be sort of some kind of in between kind of. This is complicated, and I don't know a whole lot about it. I shouldn't, you know, speak to it. Really, the experts can speak to it. But the point is, it's a pretty layered issue. But I do think, like Ubaken and Goenka, there's clear evidence that they participated in this sort of classical idea that, you know, this is a particularly, you know, challenging kind of, you know, desire that, you know, makes it harder as a meditator. And so it's something that has to be we have to be aware of it, as you said, you know. I think I was on a course once where I don't know if I was serving, but it was like, oh, you know, just keep an eye on that dude, you know. It's like, well, what, wow. You know, that kind of thing. So yeah, this is, you know, this is, I don't think I felt uncomfortable, and I, you know, I have personal experience with this also. On a long course where I felt really uncomfortable. It's a bit of a long story. Maybe I don't feel like telling it right now, but maybe at another point. Because my brother is gay, and there was, you know, it really put him off some of the attitudes that we encountered. And so, you know, this was, you know, an issue personally for me in terms of how, like, you know, on the other hand, you know, the traditions, you know, ultimately everyone is the same with regard to sexuality, right?
Yeah.
It's ultimately, you know, something that everyone is going to have to deal with in their own way, on their own terms. You know, it's a fundamental drive that, you know, lots of people have. And so, you know, it's something that comes up in meditation, and we all, you know, have to address it in its own way. So that's, you know, that's there. But it's more that, for me, the story of the tradition in this case is just a story of, like, you know, Goenka being pretty conservative and socially conservative in a lot of ways, right? And holding on to certain things for quite a while, and then at a certain point, really for the sake of spreading the Dhamma, making decisions that he personally did not want, you know, probably would never have gone along with.
Really?
On his own personal, you know, kind of ideology, but did it in order to spread the Dhamma and make, you know, give everyone access, regardless of where they're coming from. And that, you know, that's a, you know, it just shows that in that case, in quite a number of instances like that, he listened to people, he responded. Sometimes it took a lot longer than we might have liked, but there was actually movement over time. And that's also, I think, why he ended up with some of the narratives he ended up with too. Because it just, you know, he wanted to give people access. You know, that seems to be the main idea.
I think this also speaks to this wider process of transmission across culture, individuals carrying it, their personalities, of just what decisions do you make as you're entering different context, spaces, times, audiences. This is something that is so rich in Friedgaard's discussion, because we spend so much time talking about the different shades and varieties of teachers and the way they impart and their strengths and also the kind of controversies around that. And again, with Friedgaard's kind of almost, I call it like a Charles Dickens kind of way of looking into psychology and character. You know, she does this deep dive contrast into Webuseida and Ubikin and how that played out. And then talks about as Ubikin or as Goenka started to do his first courses, the innovations that he was able to make in India and beyond that, you know, Ubikin would not be so well placed to be able to make those same kind of decisions. And and eventually the staff at, and teachers at IMC, as much as they were supporting and celebrating it in later years, they came to feel he had gone too far. And Friedgaard goes into a lot of descriptions of describing their orthodoxy. And why I'm thinking of all this is in the figure of Ruth Denison, because, as she comes on the scene, you know, Ruth or Friedgaard describes how, you know, Ruth initially was charged to teach women and living in Southern California and Hollywood specifically, that came to take on the form of largely lesbians. She was largely teaching a lesbian audience at that time. And which was in and of itself, you know, and along with many of the other innovative, expressive, creative things she was doing, was uncomfortable to, as Friedgaard describes, you know, very uncomfortable to the IMC crowd, and also uncomfortable and not supported by Goenka as well. And so I think when we're looking at whether it's this question of sexuality, of homosexuality, of gender fluidity, and we look at kind of these different models of, you know, the IMC teachers and Ubikin, who, you know, Friedgaard really stresses would have, he did have some limitations in place given his background, but he also had certain kind of, you know, very flexible and adaptive models of recognizing the necessity to change as things traveled, which she feels when he left, those remained in IMC could not do. And then, you know, innovations Goenka made, and then kind of, you know, kind of off the farm, the when Ruth Denison came in and you know, where she was bringing it, the audience she was bringing it to.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know that about Ruth Denison, particularly that there was an emphasis. I knew, of course, it was on women, but of course, early on, she opened up to both women and men. Actually, that was one of the issues. I heard that, you know, that was one of the bigger issues.
That's right.
That she was going to teach men and women. I didn't know that that she was teaching largely lesbians. I've never heard that. It's certainly not in evidence in the biography about her. But who knows? And I think Ruth Denison's an interesting example of someone who very, you know, was pretty small scale. She had one center and kind of never really became a big global teacher like Goenka did. And so that a lot of these are interesting questions, of course, like these other students of Ubikin, including Leon Wright, like why they were less successful. Of course, one of my main arguments is that because of Goenka re-narrativizing these things in this certain way, it was just a very powerful thing. But I think there are a lot of factors. So reading the Insight and Perspective book helps us get more into it. But yeah, that's a bigger conversation. But in this instance, I'd say, you know, again, also like everyone had their own goals. So let's come back to Leon Wright. Like, why didn't he become such a big figure? He did end up teaching like sort of beyond his own community. But really, when we look at what his goals were, he was focused on his community. And that was, in fact, early on, Ubikin's idea that each of these different teachers was going to really be sent to their own local place and do their own local thing. And that was going to sort of filter out. And, you know, Goenka really did this thing where he went and sort of then created this large global idea. He also, you know, had encounters with others that sort of gave him some of these ideas. For instance, right, he met the Maharishi early on in his career and things like that. And also India was the center point for this large global New Age thing going on, right? So there, the context for Goenka is very unique. And I'm sure Friedgart spoke to some of that. But in terms of like the issues are like around gender and homosexuality and stuff like that, I just think Goenka is a really interesting example, precisely because he was such a conventional, old school Hindu Indian. Yeah, of course he grew up in this very unique context in Burma, but he really was raised in this very kind of traditional mold. And that's what makes it all the more remarkable how far he came, right, coming back to India and then coming into contact with this huge slew of folks in the counterculture movement, but also all across the board in India, just such different communities, such diversity. None of the other, you know, students of Ubekin really ended up having that kind of contact with just such broad kinds of communities and impact on so many people. So in many ways, like how he's just a good example of someone who really went almost like just way further than anyone else in certain ways, despite his extreme conservatism. In many ways, the conservatism of his approach sort of maybe was what enabled it to do what he did, because he was just so clear that he was going to do this one thing. And I think that was just, there was less systematicity on the part of the other folks, which just made it harder to accomplish they might not have been after the same thing. That's also an interesting question.
These are decisions that each teacher in and of themselves had to make when they were moving into different environments. And that, you know, at least in the case of Goenka and Ubekin, you mentioned how they were living inside this, quote, mode of existence that was better captured by ladies' cosmology than by modern psychology. Although, you know, each of them kind of made inroads, and even going back to Lady, you know, Lady famously was interested in science and technology and biology and the latest developments back in the time that he was living. And so, you know, as we're looking at that transmission and what that mode of existence actually was, what the assumptions were, what gets lost when it was left out of the story, we see that in Goenka centers today, you mention the role of the chanting, the atmosphere of protection, the teacher's invocation at the start of a course, many, many other features that we could mention. And so, and we could reference here. So would it be correct to say that, that as we look at this, there are references we could point to of things being lost, of things being abandoned for this reason or that reason? I mean, even just the little meta circle that we talked about just now on one hand, and then on the other hand, of these kinds of the things I just cited being examples of how those remnants remain and are directly connected to that mode of existence that we find from Lady Sayada's cosmology and what Ubekin was creating. And even if they're not necessarily recognized as such today in the way that they're being used, that the through line is very, very evident as to what they pointed to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So again, it's actually easier to point to the things that get sort of removed. But actually, yeah, I've been most interested in the things that remain and aren't legible, right? And then making them legible, you know, when they do remain is great for people. And that's one of the big projects I have, is to see that, yeah, these remnants are there, you know, and that's when I say, like, in many ways, Goenkaji's conservatism, like, it in fact is part of his success. He built this system that people had to stick to, and for better or for worse, right? It had its own problems. And of course we've now seen some of that, you know, particularly alienating people. But I think in many ways, like if we're talking about sort of the idea of maintaining a set of traditional practices that does have certain kinds of efficacy, I think that's been successful, and it's good to see it for what it is and understand the history so that it can become more legible to folks. And then there's a decision to be made, like, is this something that one can participate in, right, or not, right? And so that's been one of the big challenges as a scholar, is like, okay, show people this, right? provide them with the information, will it turn them off? Like, that could be a drag. On the other hand, if it does turn them off, it's probably better they know now, right? Understand like what they're participating in, and then they can make an informed decision. For me, I've been much more interested in what remains and why and how and the continuities and the connections and the basic frameworks that tie all these people together and that tie us to them historically, and that also, you know, acknowledge the richness of diversity of different cultures, right? Different communities, whether they're small cultic communities like Ubakins or like more larger global communities like the one Goenka built, but just seeing those formations, understanding their structures, and, you know, understanding like how one would relate to them with an eye to history, with an eye to experience, visionary experience, or maybe not so visionary experience. You know, people experience the Dhamma in different ways. And that's, you know, a classic idea from the earliest tradition, actually, right? I don't know if I've told this story, but I love that story about Moggallana and Sariputta. But there's a story from the early tradition where, you know, Sariputta is sitting in meditation and Moggallana is nearby, and he sort of looks over and he sees this this yucca. You know, in the early Pali tradition, the yucca or yaksha in Sanskrit is like a spirit that, you know, often they reside in trees, or there are these worldly spirits that are sort of in the landscape in early India. And sometimes the Buddha will teach the Dhamma to these yakshas or yakkas. And in this case, this yakka was sort of mischievous one. He ran up behind Sariputta and smacked him in the back of the head. And Moggallana, being an expert of visionary practice, saw this yakka and was surprised that he did this to Sariputta. And he goes to Sariputta and he says, hey, what's going on? What are you experiencing? And Sariputta says, well, I have a bit of a headache. And so this is, again, from the early tradition, this idea that one can experience the world in various ways. One could have a spirit hitting one on the head or just a headache, depending on the perspective one has on experience. And this, of course, could be mapped to this notion of sort of multiple levels of truth that goes back to the pretty early in the tradition, like, you know, conventional and ultimate. But of course, this is slightly, doesn't quite perfectly fit that taxonomy from the Abhidharma tradition. But anyway, I think it's a good story just to get at this idea that, yes, people experience the world in various ways, and these, like, you know, these cosmological, you know, relationalities are there for some, and some others maybe will discern them on other terms. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So
I find something really interesting you said a little bit ago, which is referencing, you know, the role of bringing this information out there. And it almost seemed like in real time, you acknowledging your own wrestling with whether if you share something about this background that does prevent someone from going to a course or makes one hesitate, you know, is that, for lack of a better word, is that ethical? Is it the right thing to do? Or is it perhaps more ethical to be able to make sure they have that information when taking it? And this touches upon something that we've talked about a lot on this podcast. We talked about just before we started recording, which was this question of access to information, who has the right to know what stories get told, and how they get broken down, and when you go outside that narrative, the kind of, you know, the kind of penalties or prohibitions for, in the case of the Goenka organization, at least in the discomfort with having information and dialogue that's happening outside of the narrative that is being presented, and just the, and I think even, you know, the conversations I've had with, especially with Jonathan Crowley, I've gotten feedback from several people saying, you know, this is really the, I really, really appreciate these conversations you've been having with them. They're so rich, but I'm also, I have to express a concern that I feel like you're saying things that are going to prevent people from going to that first course, and you'd better be careful. And I really wish you would be more mindful of what you said. And that's where it's like, I then turn it back on them and I say, well, you know, that's really interesting. Like it, what we're talking about here, and this is exactly what you said, is this, this tension and this dynamic between wanting to freely investigate and explore issues that we're finding either as practitioners or as scholars, researchers, historians, and bring them there, and that kind of protectionism with at all costs wanting to not prevent people from going and taking, especially a Goenka course, and not wanting to present information that can get in the way. And I wanna ask you a question about this by linking something else you said just now. And I'm just a single adjective that you use that is also in your writing that I've never asked about. I've always been really curious what your meaning is behind the use of this word, and that's describing Ubakin and his, you could say his entourage and his disciples, his team at IMC, as being cultic. And obviously, cultish has very strong connotations, but in the way that you're using it and in the background that you're applying it, it might not carry quite that strong connotation, or maybe it does. And so those things together, I want to ask you, you know, both about your decision to use that word and your meaning, just so we're clear with that, mm-hmm. as far as applies to Ubakin and IMC, and then also this tension between, you know, protectionism and not wanting to put barriers with people to taking Dhamma, but also wanting them to know what they're getting into.
Yeah, I mean, my general benchmark has been that, like, you know, more information is better, and like, I guess I came to a point where I thought, well, if people get the information they choose not to, right, it's probably not their thing. But that is a question. I think it's an open question. And I appreciate people who do sort of raise the question. And, you know, I think it's worth being careful. My research has been pretty careful, but, you know, it's hard. There's a mess of sources. There's a mess of material. People have different ideas. The material is also limited. And, I try my best in my writing to acknowledge that that's there and to write about the limitations of historical research, you know, the difference between documentary evidence, informants, et cetera. So that's, you know, a complication. But yeah, I worry about those issues. I've maybe become less worried about it over the years. It's been hard because, you know, of course, it bothered a lot of people, some of my just ways of narrativizing Goenka. And so, you know, I think at a certain point, once people, you know, were annoyed already, I thought, well, you know, like, it's hard to satisfy everyone. So let's try to be as honest as possible within the limitations of, you know, one's capacities. And that ultimately, hopefully, that'll help most people. I think there's always a danger that, you know, some people, the information doesn't help, right? But it's definitely hard for me to know precisely exactly when and how. So I've sort of erred on the side of giving more information or trying to be, you know, forthcoming, but also sort of acknowledging those limitations. In terms of the use of the language of cult and cultic, generally I use it descriptively, you know, within religious studies context. It doesn't have quite the same, you know, force necessarily if one isn't analyzing it through the lens of sort of cult literature in the more traditional way that nowadays we talk about things. But actually, traditionally, it's really just a descriptive term, which is, you know, why Leon Wright, for instance, talks about the early church as a cult. in the sense of, you know, a small community organized around a teacher or a set of teachings or a book. Right. And that's more in the, just the basic descriptive sense. On the other hand, it's really clear to me that the Goenka and his students and the sort of social dynamics that developed in that community and the social dynamics that were at work around Uba Khin as a devotional figure, there probably were explicitly social dynamics that fit pretty well with what like nowadays is understood as sort of cult dynamics or group behaviors. And I think it would actually be, you know, though it might not be the perfect fit, it would be valuable to analyze some of the behaviors and actions of this history through that lens. I think it will apply in a bunch of instances and in fact be useful, particularly for people who go into the tradition, get sort of sucked into a certain way of relating to it, which may or may not be helpful. You know, healthy for them. And then maybe 30 years later, they're like, well, you know, this hasn't panned out exactly, you know, and, you know, there's a need for some different way of conceptualizing this. So it could be useful, that analysis. And I think, you know, it should be done. I do think it's a tough, you know, one has to be careful, you know, because it's so easy to demonize that language, you know, very quickly becomes sort of monolithic, and then we lose track of some of the nuances. But I think it's fair enough. Any large organization, we can do this analysis with a lot of organizations, not just an organization like, you know, Goenka and his students, but like businesses, you know, companies.
Right,
I mean,
right.
The group behavior stuff, anytime there's a hierarchy, anytime we have, you know, a lot of power, like focused on certain goals, it's very easy for people to get swept up in certain like group behaviors that, you know, often a cult dynamics lens can help us pull apart, like at a sociological and psychological level. But generally I'm not using that analysis. It's a pretty rich literature actually, and it would involve a much different kind of approach. I'm doing a historical analysis, largely using that language as, you know, a descriptive term to note that, hey, there are the key figures. Often they're you know, figures of that have a devotional status. Often there's a small community that's sort of at the center of the, you know, dynamics. And then in Goenka's case, a much larger community sort of built around this smaller community, right? That, you know, that has, you know, a clear hierarchy and stuff like that.
So this has been another really wide ranging conversation. I really thank you for taking your time to join. I mean, these years and decades of your work and to spend time with us, being able to talk conversationally, there's nothing like this out there. And I know from listeners, you know, just how much they've appreciated the past iterations. I look forward to continuing this on. And I just want to give a deep appreciation for you taking the time to share this extensive work you've done in this conversational format, because I know how much work you've put into the academic side of it. I want to leave with one question, because we opened with Dr. Leon Wright. I'd like to close with Dr. Leon Wright. He's been an incredible figure to be able to use as kind of our somewhat of our anchor in entering this world and then going to all the different places we went. As we go back to the story of Dr. Wright, I'd like to ask you what stays with you most about that? What particularly moves you beyond the academic when you think of the story of Dr. Leon Wright?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was most interested in, you know, the connection to sort of the global solidarity, you know, against like colonial and, you know, powerful forces. So this idea that, you know, a black guy in America, right, would go to Burma and connect with, you know, the accountant general there, who's really pushing a kind of, you know, anti-colonial agenda, and kind of build it around, you know, the practice of meditation, that's very interesting and compelling. And particularly when we have histories of people like Gandhi and Martin Luther King, who were inspired in different ways, but also kind of tied their ideas to spiritual traditions, right? So again, that interface between politics and religion, but also thinking about solidarity across the globe, like for people who are oppressed. That's always been something like close to my heart. And I was raised up in traditions that were, you know, really, you know, grew up during the Cold War, thinking about ways to bring solidarity across communities in situations where people were highly polarized. This definitely seems to, like, was one of the things that drew me to the story. But also, like any story where someone has been, you know, or rather a person's story has not been told and their story deserves to be told, we've left them out in some way and they deserve a place, right? This was one of the things that compelled me to bring Leon Wright into the narrative of modern mindfulness. So.
Thank you for joining us for this meaningful conversation. At Insight Myanmar Podcast, we aim to create a space that embodies the quality of generosity, or dana, as it is known in Pali, the language of the Buddha. Dana refers to the practice of giving freely with a heart of compassion. On our side, we offer these podcast conversations without any barrier or paywall, modeling our work on the Buddhist principle that compassionate giving benefits both the giver and the one who receives the gift. But while these conversations are, and will continue to be, offered freely, there are nonetheless costs associated with the production. So if you found these conversations of value, we invite you to consider supporting our work. Visit insightmyanmar.org/donation to learn more about how you can contribute today. Thank you for your generosity, your volition, and your attention. Yarananga yaunya na da du ya danam jadi ganesa de mana we gara besayana besayo hoba yarananda da yarananga na yarananya da yaranam